Our scripture reading this morning is taken from Esther, chapter 3, verses 1 through 11. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman of Hammamatha, an Agite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore, they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw Mordecai would not kneel down or pay honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, they cast the pur, that is, the lot, in the presence of Haman to select a day and a month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There is a certain people dispersed and scattered among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business." So the king took the signet ring off his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammamatha, an Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. "Keep the money," the king said to Haman, "and do with the people as you please."
Every good movie needs an effective bad guy. And who is your favorite bad guy from the movies? This past week, I tried to come up with a list of bad guys or bad girls from various movies, and here's the list I came up with. See if you recognize some of these folks. First of all, we have Mr. Potter from It's a Wonderful Life, who wanted to squeeze out every dollar from Bedford Falls. Next, we have Liberty Valance, for those of you that like westerns, from the man who shot Liberty Valance, that movie. He was someone who had no regard for the law. He didn't care what anybody said to him. He was going to do what he wanted to do. Next, we have the Wicked Witch of the West from The Wizard of Oz, who wanted Dorothy's slippers and kidnapped Dorothy to try to get them. Next, we have Biff from Back to the Future, that teenager who was trying to bully Marty McFly. Ivan Drago, the Russian boxer who opposed Rocky in Rocky IV. Next, we have Cruella DeVille from 101 Dalmatians, who wanted that fur from the dog so she could make it special, make money off of it. Scar from The Lion King, who killed his brother Mufasa and blamed it on Simba. Next, we have Emperor Commodus from Gladiator, who hated Maximus and made him become a slave and tried to kill him. And then finally, we have Lord Voldemort from Harry Potter. Don't you love that picture? Killed Harry Potter's parents, tried to kill Harry. You know, you probably would have more on this list and other movies you can think of, but in some ways, all of these characters, they're antagonists. And what I mean by that is they're people who oppose the main character in the movie, the main hero in the movie. And the antagonist, they're the ones that create the problem. They're the ones that create the conflict. They're the ones that make the movie suspenseful because we don't know exactly how things are going to turn out. And so a movie, in order for it to be effective and a good story, often needs an effective bad guy. Well, we're in the middle of this study of the book of Esther. If you're our guest this morning, we've been walking through the story of Esther. And I've mentioned several times that the story of Esther unfolds kind of like a movie. That's why we have this movie set prop up here. And that there are different scenes and there's different characters and there's different settings, just kind of like a movie. And this morning, we're going to look at the character that is the bad guy in this movie of Esther. And that character is Haman. And we learn about Haman in Esther chapter 3. And if you have your Bibles, please open them to Esther chapter 3. The first thing we learn about Haman when he is introduced to us is that he has been honored by King Xerxes. And we don't know why he was honored. We don't know if he did anything to deserve this honor. I mentioned last week that it's kind of interesting, the dichotomy that Mordecai at the end of chapter 2 does a good deed but receives no honor. Beginning of chapter 3, Haman receives honor, but we don't know if he did a good deed at all. In fact, maybe he didn't do a good deed at all. But still, Xerxes honors him, gives him a role that is higher than any other noble, basically making him the prime minister of Persia, the king's right-hand man. And to go along with it, the king gives this command that says whenever Haman walks into the room, everyone has to bow down and pay honor to him. And so when he walks into the room, that's what all the nobles do, except for one, Mordecai. We don't know exactly why Mordecai doesn't bow down and pay honor to Haman. The text doesn't actually say. Some people think that maybe he doesn't bow down to Haman for religious reasons. Maybe he believed that he's only to worship God. And so if he's bowing down to a man, maybe he's worshiping a man when he should be only worshiping God. But I actually believe that that's not the case. Because in Eastern culture, people would often bow down to other people out of respect. It was just a way of showing respect to another person. And if you go a little further in the story, there is a moment where Esther bows down before the king. So if Mordecai didn't bow down to Haman for religious reasons or religious convictions, we would expect Esther to do the same thing, which she does not. So instead, I think there's maybe another reason why Mordecai doesn't bow down to Haman. And I think we find that reason bound up in this word in verse 1, where it says in chapter 3, verse 1, that after these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Now, to understand the impact of this word, the Agagite, we've got to put our thinking caps on. I hope you're ready for this. And we're going to do a little Old Testament history. We're going to go all the way back to the book of Exodus. And if you remember in the book of Exodus, the people of Israel were wandering through the wilderness, going to the land of Canaan. And it says in Exodus 17 that while they were going towards Canaan, that the Amalekites attacked Israel. In fact, later on it says that they attacked them when they were tired and weary and vulnerable. And so God tells Moses to respond to that attack. And there's this whole story where Moses and Joshua, they get the troops together and they go and fight the Amalekites. And as long as Moses has his hands up, then Israel wins. His arms get a little tired, his shoulders get weary, and he starts to lower down his arms. And so Israel's not winning. And so Aaron and Hur stand next to him, raise up his arms, and Israel defeats the Amalekites. This is the story in Exodus 17. Well, at the very end of the story, there's this little line that I want you to notice. In Exodus 17, verse 16, it says this, "The Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation. It's an interesting point. Fast forward a few years. Now the people of Israel are in the land of Canaan, and they decide they want a king. And so God anoints Saul to be the first king of Israel. And God comes to Saul through the prophet Samuel and says, I want you, remember those Amalekites who attacked us when we were vulnerable, when we were tired and weary? I want to take care of that. And so I want you to go and attack the Amalekites. I want you to completely destroy this people. In fact, I want you to destroy the livestock of the people. And so Saul gathers up the troops and he goes and attacks the Amalekites. And then Samuel comes back to Saul and Saul says, okay, I did what God asked me to do. And Samuel says, hang on a second. I hear something. I hear the bleating of sheep. I hear the lowing of oxen. They didn't kill off all the livestock. And Saul says, well, hang on a second. Well, I just did this because we wanted to have the choicest of livestock to offer sacrifice to God. Well, it's also true that they didn't kill off every person. They didn't kill the king. And do you know the name of the king of the Amalekites? Agag. Agag. I mentioned last week that Mordecai was descendant of the tribe of Benjamin. Does anyone want to guess what tribe Saul was from? Benjamin. Is there a coincidence here? Samuel eventually tells Saul, God is going to judge you because you've disobeyed God's command. You haven't done everything that God said to do. You haven't handled the Amalekites correctly. You didn't handle Agag correctly, and so God is going to judge you. And as you keep going that through Israel history and Jewish history, often rabbis, when they would refer to an enemy of the Jewish people, an enemy that is kind of a thorn in Israel's side, an enemy that creates problems, an enemy that gets under their skin, they use the term Amalekite or Agagite. And so when the author says that Haman was the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, that is code language, church. That is code language to tell us that Haman either is a physical descendant of King Agag from that story in 1 Samuel 15, or he is just someone who is an arch enemy of the Jews. And so just like Batman has the Joker, just like Luke Skywalker has Darth Vader, just like Bambi has the Hunter, I thought that was a joke, okay? The Jews had Haman the Agagite. That word means that he is an arch enemy to the Jews based on the previous stories in Exodus and 1 Samuel. And so I think that Mordecai doesn't bow down to Haman because he doesn't want to respect someone who's an Agagite. He doesn't want to give the pleasure to someone who is an arch enemy to the Jews. He doesn't want to do anything to pay homage to someone who's against the covenant people of God. And so he doesn't bow down. Well, Haman finds out about this. And when you're a very prideful person like Haman, everybody can be doing what you want them to do, but if there's one person who doesn't, that's all you focus on. And that gets under your skin, and it's a burr in your saddle, and you don't like that one guy won't bow down, and he gets upset. And when he finds out what people Mordecai is a part of, that he's a part of the Jewish people, he just gets downright angry. And he decides he's going to do something about this. Because he has power and he has authority and he is number two in all the land. He decides he's going to take this one act of disobedience and disrespect and he's going to cause it to send shockwaves to the whole empire. Kind of like what happened with Vashti, if you remember that part of the story. And he's going to use this moment to be an opportunity to get rid of and commit genocide against the Jewish people. Now, in order to do this, he's got to get the king on board. So he makes a visit to King Xerxes, and he gives this little speech. And this speech is a classic example of manipulation. He tells one truth, he tells one half-truth, he tells one bald-faced lie, and then he offers a bribe. That's how you manipulate somebody. Let me break it down for us. Here's what he says. First of all, he says the truth. He says, there's a certain people dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Okay, now that is actually true. The people of Israel, because of the exile, they are scattered and they are dispersed throughout the Persian Empire. They're not the only group of people like that. There were many groups of people that were scattered and dispersed, but it is true that the Jews are scattered and dispersed. Well, here's the half-truth. He says, these people, this group of people, their customs are different from those of other peoples. Okay, that's kind of true. I mean, the Jews, they did have different customs. They did have certain food laws that they followed. They observed the Sabbath day. They circumcised their males. There was a few things that they did that was a little bit different. But when those things didn't conflict with Persian law, they followed Persian law. So it wasn't like that they were incredibly strange and weird. There were other groups of people that had their own customs too, and they would follow Persian law the same way as the Jews did. And so it's kind of true, but it's kind of not true. And then here we have the bald-faced lie. He says, this group of people, they just don't obey the king's laws. Okay, now you're lying, Haman. You're being dishonest. That was not true. The Jewish people, when they were in exile and afterwards, they tried to follow the civil law of the country that they were in. They tried to obey, when appropriate, the laws of the king. He's just lying now. But you see what he's trying to do. He's trying to stir up this idea in the king's mind that there's this group of people and they're a little bit strange and they're a little bit weird and they're all over your empire and they're not following your law. They're being rebellious. You need to get rid of them. He's trying to stir up racism. He's trying to make the king have hatred towards this strange group of people. And then to sweeten the pot, he offers a bribe, because we all know that money talks. And so he says at the end that if you'll do this, I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury, a whole lot of money. And according to historians, that would have been very sweet for the King Xerxes, because according to history books, he had depleted his royal treasury trying to attack Greece. And so here comes Haman, and he offers this idea, can we get rid of this group of people? And maybe he didn't fully understand exactly what he was saying, but when he sees the dollar signs, he says, Haman, do with these people what you want. Go ahead. And so Haman rolls what's called pur, which is kind of like a dice. He rolls that dice, and it comes up with a month, the month of Adar. And on that month, there's going to be a certain day, and on that day, everyone in the Persian Empire can attack the Jewish people and can plunder what they have and totally annihilate the Jews. And this isn't just the Jews in Persia. This is through the whole empire. These are even the Jews in Jerusalem. Everybody can be destroyed. That's what this decree said. And then this decree was spread out through the whole empire in every language for everybody to know. Now, the question I want us to think about at this point in the story is, where is God? Where is God as Haman creates this spirit of hatred and racism against God's people? Where is God when Haman begins to manipulate and lie to the king to get his way? Where is God as Haman devises a plan to commit genocide against his covenant people and totally ruin God's redemptive plan? Where's God in all of this? Where is God as Haman, this evil, prideful man, is trying to get his way? Where's God in all of this? We live in a broken world, church. And because we live in a broken world, there are going to be occasions where there is a Haman in your life. Where there is someone who is in your life, engaging in your world, and they lie about you, and they manipulate other people against you, and they gossip about you, and they just try to bring you down. There's going to be times where you have someone like that in your life. And I want you to think about, just for a second, who's the Haman in your life right now? Don't point fingers. Okay? Who's the Haman in your life? Who's that person who just, every time you're around them, it just seems like they get underneath your skin? Who's that person that whenever you're trying to be friendly to them, there's just some conflict and animosity there, and you don't know why, but it's just there. Who's that person? Who's that person who stabbed you in the back? You didn't do anything to deserve it, but they did it anyways. Who's the Haman in your life? We live in a broken world, and because of that, there are going to be occasions where we experience, as the people of God, Haman-like situations. And what I mean by that, situations where there's some person, some group, some organization, some government, some country, some group of people that are trying to threaten God's people. And who is that person who's creating a Haman-like situation for our church? Who's that group or organization that really is bothering you because it seems like they're threatening Christians and hurting Christians? Who is that organization or government or nation that it seems like is just completely opposed to the people of God? Who is that? I want you to think about that in your mind. Who is it that you feel like is creating a Haman-like situation for the church, either for our church locally or for the church global? And how do we respond to the Hamans in our life? How do we respond when that person lies about us and treats us unfairly? How do we handle it as the church when there is a group of people or there's a person or an individual or some kind of organization that it seems to be directly against Christians? How do we respond to that? Church, there's a strain in our culture, and it's bleeding into the church, unfortunately, that says when you have someone in your life that's a Haman, or someone who's creating this Haman-like situation and threatening God's people, here's what you do. You take them out. That's what you do. And I'm seeing this vindictive spirit develop more and more in our country. I see it in the Facebook feeds. I see it in our media. I see it in emails and how we talk about politicians and how we talk about people and how we talk about individuals and how we talk about groups and nations, that the strain of vindictiveness is bleeding into the church, and we have this idea that if someone's a bad guy, we take them out. We vilify them. And I don't think that's the right way to respond. I don't know if that's how God calls us to be. You know, in the movies, it's pretty easy to tell who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. Sometimes they're even dressed in black and dressed in white. And it's pretty easy to tell in the book of Esther who's on our side and who's not on our side. But it's not always that easy in real life. And sometimes we can get a little bit mixed up. And if we're not careful, if we have a vindictive spirit against someone else, we might actually become the Haman in someone else's life. And so how do we respond to Hamans and Haman-like situation? And I think the answer to that question comes from the answer to that previous question of where is God? Where is God in this whole situation in chapter 3 where the whole people of God become threatened because of Haman's prideful and evil spirit? I'll tell you where God is. He's in the midst of the story. Now, you can't see him, and he's never mentioned. He's behind the scenes. He's kind of like the director of the movie. He knows exactly what's going on, and he's not going to allow evil to triumph. And so through simple ways and simple actions, he slowly weaves a story where it doesn't happen where Haman thinks it's going to happen. Haman thinks he has all power and all authority because the king has given him the keys and he can drive the car and do whatever he wants to do. But actually there was someone with more power, right? There was someone with more authority. There was someone with more wisdom. And who was that? It was our God. And so as we flip through the story, the people of God do not become annihilated. Instead, they thrive. And Haman and his family actually are executed. And Mordecai actually becomes the prime minister of Persia. God works in his time and in his way and in his method to overturn evil and to make things right. Our God is a just God. I believe that. He is a just God, and he will by no means let the guilty go unpunished. Scripture says that several times. And so when evil happens, just like last week when Mordecai did that good deed and nobody noticed, we talked about there was somebody who noticed. It was God. And this week, Haman does all this evil and creates this huge evil plan, and no one seems to be able to stop him. But there was somebody who noticed, and it was God. And he did something about it. He made things right. He's a just God, and he makes sure that no one guilty goes unpunished. And if I believe that to be true about Haman and about Mordecai and the whole story of Esther, it has to be true about my life as well. That God is a just God. He's proven that he has more power over evil. He's proven that at the cross and the resurrection when God raised Jesus from the dead 3 days after the crucifixion, declaring that him being Lord over life and death, he's proven that there is no evil power that can rise up above him. And if I believe that to be true, when I'm dealing with a Haman in my life, or a Haman-like situation in my life, my response is not to be vindictive or bitter or angry or full of hatred. My response is to wait on God. Because in his time and in his way and in his method, he will make it right. And so when that person at the office lies about me to the boss, I don't start lying about them. I wait on God. When that person at school starts spreading rumors about me that are just not true, I don't start spreading rumors about them. I wait on God. When that professor messes me over in class, I don't start spewing hatred on the teacher evaluation form. I wait on God. When that Christian brother or sister manipulates people against me, spreads lies about me, I don't vilify their character to other people. I wait on God. When injustice happens against me that is not my fault and I am treated unfairly, I don't get mad and bitter and vindictive. I wait on God. When someone discriminates against me because of my race or maybe even because of my gender, I don't start to have this bitter spirit that just broods everywhere. I wait on God. Whenever there's evil in my life and there's a Haman in my life, I don't get mad, angry, and full of hate. I wait on God. Why? Because God is on the throne and he sees the evil in this world, and in his time and in his way and in his method, he will make it right. And I'm going to trust in him. Scholars have noticed that the story of Esther is in many ways very similar to the story of Joseph. Story found in Genesis chapters 37 through 50. Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers, treated unfairly, goes down to Egypt, actually does the right thing like Mordecai in resisting the advances of Potiphar's wife, but instead of being rewarded for it, he's lied about by Potiphar's wife and ends up in prison. The baker tells him his dream, and Joseph helps him and says, hey, when you get out of prison, please remember me when you go to Pharaoh. And the baker forgets. And so here's Joseph. He's in prison basically because his family sold him into slavery, because people have lied about him and manipulated others against him, and because people have forgotten about him. Now, if you were Joseph, how would you feel? I imagine that many of us would feel angry and upset, and we'd be mad at God, because we'd say, God, where are you? Do you see all the injustice that has happened to me? Where are you? And you know where God was? He was right in the middle of the story. He was right there in prison with Joseph. And sure enough, in his time and in his way and his method, he made it all right, didn't he? When eventually Joseph was brought out of prison, set free from that, and eventually became second in all the land, saving that region from starvation through his wisdom. Joseph says this at the very end of the story. He says to his brothers, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. And I think that's the perspective we have. When we wait on God and we trust that God's going to take care of things in his time, it could be that down the road we will look back and say, you know what? What somebody meant to hurt me, that Haman in my life who was trying to do evil to me, God has turned that around and he has used that for good. And praise God for that. And so I want to encourage us this morning. We're going to have our invitation. Our elders and ministers are going to surround the auditorium. And I just want to encourage you, if there's a Haman in your life and you need encouragement and prayer, I encourage you to walk to one of your spiritual leaders and just let them pray over you. You don't have to go into details. You don't have to name names. We don't want you to name names, okay? But maybe you need some prayer and encouragement this morning. And that's why we're here, to be church, to be family. Or maybe you're ready to be baptized into Christ, have your sins washed away, to be welcomed into the family of God. If we can help you this morning, we want to do that. Let's stand and sing at this time, and please come if you need help.